Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Bruno Barron, Philip Beverly, and Charles Lipsom. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Sirius XM Studios on Chicago's Great West Side, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. And if you'd like to send us an email address, it's btb@museum.tv. That's btb@museum.tv. Going to be talking politics for the next couple of hours, but we begin the program with some celebration in that Captain Richard Phillips is safe, the 53-year-old merchant marine captain who had been held captive for the last 4 days by Somali pirates. He is safe and sound thanks to the Navy SEALs, and three of the four pirates are now dead because of a dramatic military action which took place earlier in the day. And this was for if you have not read the stories or heard the news, President Obama had granted permission for the military operation to the U.S. Navy. They were charged with using appropriate force. And according to one of the commanding admirals at the site, he said that the captain was in imminent danger. And if he was not in imminent danger, they were not to take this sort of action. This, according to Vice Admiral Bill Courtney, who was the commander of the U.S. Naval Forces, the Central Command. And then he went on to say, quote, he had a weapon aimed at him, and on the scene, the on-the-scene commander saw that that weapon was aimed at him. And so when the opportunity offered itself, not too much later, three pirates are dead. And it happened at a time when the captain was able to jump overboard and was rescued by the U.S. Navy. So this appears to be a very happy ending to a story that has dominated much world news over the last 4 days. Charles Lipsom from the University of Chicago, we were prepared to discuss the issue of piracy. We'll talk a little bit about it.
Let's
talk about the military response. And this basically is a successful military operation, the first one of President Obama's, reign, and your reaction.
Well, it's awfully impressive. The Navy SEALs and all of the Special Forces units around the world have been doing incredible operations. Most of the time, we don't hear about it. We know that there are some in Iran right now, for example, doing this. But the problem of piracy has become a very serious problem. It used to be a problem with all the oil that was moving past Indonesia in the Straits of Malacca. The Indonesians have done a lot to stop that. Now the big problems seem to be off of the Gulf of Aden, off of Somalia, and increasingly also off of Nigeria. The basic problem in Somalia is you have gangs of thugs. You have a government that's completely melted down. You have an economy that's melted down. And these ex-fishermen are, in effect, going out and stealing whatever they can and then hooking up with, in effect, gangs of mafioso who will sell the cargo for a ransom.
We should also mention that in conversations with George Stephanopoulos of ABC, one of the Navy commanders said this is going to make a great movie. And we should also report that President Obama has already reached out. He has spoken to Captain Phillips, who is now on a second ship, having been rescued and moved around. And also, he has spoken to the captain's wife in Vermont as well. Bruno Barron, your reaction to this a rather dramatic military action this afternoon.
I can't say enough about the West in this case actually being smart and doing what they ought to do. Didn't have as good of a turnout for the recent French operation where the rich boat owner who had his family out there, he was killed in a rescue operation. Not as good of an outcome, but it's nice to see that we're not really bargaining with the pirates and we're just taking him out. And it's also good to see that with this Alabama Maersk, I believe, boat, that the crew fought back. So this is good to see. And while I'm a harsh critic of President Obama on many issues, he made the right call on this one.
Philip Beverly joins us, professor at Chicago State University. This is the first time in the history of this program we're in our 29th year. This is the first time there has been a Democratic president with a successful military operation. Democrat, you're happy about this?
I am. I think we forget sometimes that Democrats often end up having to clean up stuff that was started in previous administrations and don't tend to have the same sort of predilection toward violence, apparently. I thought it was an inevitable thing that military force was going to be used. It's unfortunate, though, that the message won't get across to more of the Somali pirates. I think this is only going to be the first in a number of operations that we're going to have to mount there.
In a statement released by the White House after it was known that Captain Phillips was safe, the White House reported that they are now resolved to halt the rise of piracy in this region. To achieve that goal, we must continue to work with our partners to prevent future attacks, be prepared to interdict any act of piracy, and to ensure that those who commit piracy in the future are held accountable for their crimes. And so the question is, how aggressive are we going to be in that point?
Well, there was a weak-toothed resolution at the UN last year, but my sense is that what's really at stake here is that there's so much oil that's moving through this area. Plus, the pirates have become bolder, and they're now moving out into the Indian Ocean. This area cannot all be patrolled. So there's a question of what you're going to do and whether any of the other states are going to step up. The real problem on a lot of this is that on issue after issue around the world, everybody looks to the United States. They want us to pay the bill. They want us to do everything. And then when we don't do it exactly the way they want to criticize us. For example, if we don't handle this the captured pirate exactly the right way, you can be assured that human rights groups and others are going to come in and say that he wasn't granted all of his due legal rights under the law to be tried in the right way.
And in this particular case, according to the initial report, the captain was relieving himself over the side of the boat when the other pirates were shot.
And I assume that would disturb the EU on the pollution grounds.
Yes, it was. It was an environmental issue where they made the move. I want to get a reaction from everybody listening to the broadcast this evening. 1-800-723-8289. Obviously, we're not going to spend the entire show on it. But again, there was some that suggested today. One commentator on the air, I was a little bit surprised when they said it, but I almost fell off my chair as a matter of fact, because they thought somehow that the loss of three pirate lives, was somehow going to have an impact on other pirates and on potential terrorists, because they might be thinking twice about conducting some action against the United States because three pirates got killed. I want to get your reaction to that. I fell off the chair when I heard that assessment. Let's find out what you had to say. 1-800-723-8289. I'm Bruce Dumont. From Bakersfield, California to Boston, Massachusetts, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. We're going to take calls on the piracy issue in just a moment. But I also want to talk and spend a little bit of time getting reaction from those in studio about the president's recent trip last week to Europe, where he gave several major addresses. And Charles Krauthammer, the conservative commentator, basically described it that he was traveling around Europe, basically offering a basket full of mea culpas with varying degrees of directness or obliqueness. He basically indicted his own people for arrogance, for dismissiveness, for derisiveness, for genocide, for torture, for Hiroshima, for Guantanamo, and for insufficient respect of the Muslim world. Those are Charles Krauthammer's assessment mm-hmm. of what the president had to say. And basically, he ended up by getting nothing. He didn't get any help from any of the those that he was speaking out, basically hoping he'd get some support. He wanted NATO to beef up their support for the troops in Afghanistan. Didn't get that. Didn't get Europe to go along with additional stimulus spending. Didn't get the Russians to speak out in support of the U.S. policy in Iran. Didn't get China to do anything to speak out against the missile test by the North Koreans. And when he talked about Guantanamo, France decided they were going to take one prisoner, and that was about it. So it was, despite the rhetoric, despite the large crowds, it was the speech, the trips, all the speeches in the trip was a big bust. Do you agree with that?
I was following the headlines, and from the bump in the polls, you could say that it wasn't a big bust. I believe that every time a new president goes overseas and gets his face on the camera quite a bit, he gets a bump in the polls. So from a political perspective here, combined with the Somali pirate operation, I'm sure Barack Obama is going to get his bump from that. I didn't see it as stark of a failure. I just think that this is the world that Barack Obama inhabits. Everybody thinks that it was George Bush that people hated about America when it comes to Europe, and oh, now we've got the new president and he's going to save the world. Europe and America have been drifting apart for a long time, and they were never going to open up their checkbooks for helping the U.S. in anything. But they probably love to hear the mea culpas.
Philip Everly, what is your reaction, and especially to those critics who feel that a president should not go on foreign soil and criticize the United States?
I agree that presidents shouldn't criticize our country, and to take responsibility for what we do, he's the only one who can. As the head of state and the head of government, he's the one who speaks for the country. We may not like that. Next time I say vote for somebody else. I like how he responded after the election in saying to a lot of Republican criticism, look, I won. And the American people have entrusted me with this, so this is what needs to be said.
Did he go too far in your view, Charles Lipson, in anything that he had to say?
I don't think he went too far. The one thing that really disturbed me was just an atmospherics issue of bowing to the king of Saudi Arabia. We don't bow to anyone. But the fact is, I thought that some of the apologies were simply resetting the atmospherics. There was just a tremendous enthusiasm in Europe for Obama. I've been in Europe. I've talked to a number of Europeans during the election season. There was a lot of enthusiasm, but I think...
But he was playing to the crowd.
He was playing to the crowd, but I think that Bruno was right in saying... And Charles Krauthammer was certainly right in saying he didn't come back with anything. The reason is atmospherics will only get you so far. It can set the context for new negotiations. But the fact is, why should the Europeans put up any blood and treasure for Afghanistan, given the fact that the Americans are on the hook for it?
Let's go to calls. Let's go to Lee listening to us in Hammond, Indiana, on our flagship station, WLS. Go ahead, Lee. You're on the air.
How you doing, Bruce?
Okay.
Yeah, I just had a comment on on the situation here with this piracy off the coast of Somalia. I don't understand what's going on with the West. It's like this whole political correctness thing has just gotten to the point where all the Western powers are just being hamstrung by it. You know, it just seems like the most obvious thing to do is you have to arm these maritime crews. These guys need a way to defend themselves. They've got to have a way to defend themselves. You know, this whole thing with expecting these people to repel somebody with AK-47 with a fire hose, I mean, that's just ridiculous.
Well, one of the things that's been said, though, is that would require additional training, and frankly, if there isn't some significant training, maybe more people would end up getting shot. And also in this particular case, if I can just finish this point,
sure.
Some might suggest also that really part of the toughness that you're looking for is there has to be more toughness on the part of the companies that own the ships. They've got to just say, we're not going to pay the ransom, period.
Well, yeah, but that of course, would be somewhat helpful. But let's face it, if these people are going to get hold of the cargo, they really don't care about the ransom. They'll sell it off, break it up, whatever they have to do with it, unless they're stopped. This whole thing about these, handling a firearm being some great some kind of a it almost has to be like a calling or something like that. I don't buy that. These guys are handling thousands and tens of thousands of tons of ship and cargo. I'm sure they're competent enough to be able to learn how to use a firearm.
Philip Beverly's got a comment for you.
Sure. I agree with the caller. I would like to see some of the private contractors that have previously been at work in Iraq get an opportunity to partner with the shipping companies. And I think that provides much more of a deterrent than even the military, because then you don't have to worry about the government operating outside of its own laws, and that private security ends the problem.
Lee, thanks very much. Let's go to Edward listening to us in Chicago on WLS. You're on Coast to Coast. Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you very much. Well, I think some of this problems comes back from the failed Clinton policy when he was unable to deal with the Somalis in 1993. Mm-hmm. And I think what Mr. Obama needs to do is continue with the Bush policy with missile defense, not so much with putting troops on the ground, but using human intelligence and missile defense.
Well, he appears, the signal is that he's not going to be doing much of that. He's going to maybe going in the opposite direction.
Well, human intelligence is something that we've had to rebuild ever since Jimmy Carter and others just completely dismantled it. I think that that's really beginning to pay off. I think that's right. Missile defense may or may not be a good idea, but it has nothing to do with the piracy issue. The piracy.
But last week he called for drastic cuts in missile defense.
That's correct.
What signal is that sending? Now, granted, he wants to have a world without nuclear weapons. That's a wonderful concept. It's a wonderful concept. But how are you going to protect the United States? And you say that in a week. You say that in a week where the North Koreans have fired nuclear weapons.
Bingo, Bruce. I think you've got it exactly right. I think that these are signals of weakness.
And my view, I'll just say this. I think everybody understands it. A world without nuclear weapons would have been a world that was mired in conventional war for the last 40 years. It's ridiculous to want a world without nuclear weapons. The fact that they exist is they almost create the situation where they'll never be used, so we all get along better. To the last caller's point, Lee, and I agree with Philip here, this is a wonderful opportunity for private contractors. This is a wonderful opportunity to be hiring some of the kids that are out of the military if they want to see the world and continue working.
Blackwater. It's more business for Blackwater.
I agree with one element of the new defense program that's being unveiled by Gates and being backed, it appears, by the Obama administration, and that is we're really reorienting the military so that it can fight the wars we currently have. Right. I think that those have to include protecting our ships against piracy.
Barbara in Woodstock, Illinois. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. The death of three pirates is not going to stop them. I believe we need to get tough, just like President of France Sarkozy did last year when he went in with his commandos and they took it upon themselves to go after these pirates. That's what we need to do. We need to get tough.
Well, so you're suggesting military operations within Somalia. I understand there are plans, according to some published reports, there are plans to do that, commando raids inside Somalia to knock out these camps. Is that what you're talking about?
But that's what the president did. His grouping went in there last year and did that.
Right. So you're suggesting that the United States should do more of it because it's some of these actions may already have been done and we don't even know about it.
Well, that's probably true. But I just feel if we don't stand up and have a tough policy that it's going to continue and continue and continue.
But what about the way we handled this situation? I mean, what we have here is there were four pirates. Three of them are dead. One has been taken into custody. The captain is safe. The crew is safe. Granted, they spent four uncomfortable days. But isn't that success?
Well, I know, but I probably would have sent in the SEALs underwater. I probably would have done a lot of other.
No, but that's exactly what they did, ma'am. They sent in the Navy SEALs. They were the people that led to this. And I'm asking you, what more did you want them to do other than maybe you would have wanted them to do this within 20 minutes?
No, I was more concerned that they were going to send other pirate ships to the area, making it more difficult to do their job. That was my main concern.
They actually did that, and then we sent in a response. There are three things you can do. You can do more intensive patrolling. You can do what Professor Beverly said. You can do a harder response when they take over. You can arm things. And you can do convoys of ships. My hunch is that we'll move to all of those. Plus, we'll move into having things like Blackwater, which will probably rename Z, have its own navy to try to protect these convoys.
They also were concerned that, again, the lifeboat was inching, you know, not inching, but moving rather quickly towards Somalia waters, so they didn't want that to happen. 1-800-723-8029 from coast to coast and border to border, talking about the policy, the Obama policy, foreign policy. Your reaction. From Sioux Falls, South Dakota to Grand Rapids, Michigan, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. 1-800-723-8029 is the telephone number if you want to send us an email. It's btb@museum.tv, whether that is during the broadcast each and every week or if you've got comments or suggestions about the show, btb@museum.tv. Bruno Barron is with us tonight. He is a political consultant. He is an author. He runs a website called extremewisdom.com.
Philip, I like the title.
I like it, Bruno.
Outstanding.
Philip Beverly also joins us. He is an associate professor of political science at Chicago State University, where he has worked for the last 17 and a half years. And Charles Upson from the University of Chicago also joins us, a political science professor, and also the pride of Marks, Mississippi. They all join us tonight on Beyond the Beltway, 1-800-723-8029. We're talking about the trip of the president last week to Europe. And when he was in Prague, he was suggesting that he wanted to commit the United States to a world without nuclear weapons. He also took note of North Korea's missile launch that took place just hours earlier. And then he proclaimed in a rather significant way, quote, "Rules must be binding. Violations must be punished. Words must mean something. The world must stand together to prevent the spread of these weapons. Now is the time for a strong international response." And what did the UN do? Nada.
So the question is, what is Barack Obama going to do? The UN is not going to do anything because China is going to protect anything against North Korea. Russia and China will protect anything against Iran. If we don't do something, nobody will do it. And the issues in both the case of North Korea and Iran are serious and growing more so.
And with the with Russia and China on the Security Council, when things get hot in the world, can we ever, in your view, Philip Beverly, count on the United Nations?
No. No, and I am not.
And you are our liberal tonight.
I'm the liberal tonight, and
useless.
The United Nations
don't call Philip useless.
Has its place in the world.
United Nations.
And the United Nations has its place, but when the issues are the sort of shooting war issues, that's when nation states need to take care of whatever their national interests are. And the United States should always protect its national interests and never necessarily rely on the United Nations.
What, in your view—
With liberals like that, who needs conservatives?
Bruno, look into the crystal ball. What's going to happen with North Korea? What's going to happen with Iran? I mean, if we get together on this program in the next five years, are we going to have two more members of the nuclear club?
Probably, and I don't understand why it has to be that way. First of all, I think that the Iranian problem, if we don't act, is going to be solved by the Israelis, and because they don't really have much of a choice. They can wait for us and hope that we do something, and if we do something, then they don't have to. But if we don't do anything, if we don't stop Iran, then they're almost left without a choice but to take care of it on their own.
What about North Korea?
I have had my own little idea about North Korea, and I'd like to ask these experts what they think of it, because I'm just a author blogger. They're actually experts and look at this stuff. But I've never understood why we don't go to China and say, "You like trading with us? Fine. We're going to give you 6 months. We're going to shut out every single Chinese good. We don't care if Americans have to pay a little bit more for their shopping at Walmart. We're going to shut out every Chinese good from the United States of America until you put that dog to sleep." Is that an extreme position,
Philip?
The position is an extreme. The reality of it is we don't manufacture anything here anymore. We've offshored and outsourced everything to China. China, if you look at sort of the world, is the manufacturing hub of the entire world. And so we really end up disadvantaging ourselves by trying to put that kind of pressure on them. And we do need to put pressure on them. The other part of that reality is they hold a lot of our debt.
Mm-hmm.
They hold an enormous amount of our debt given the nature of their economy. And that's not something I think we want to tinker with.
Charles,
we can't do that against China for all the reasons that have been stated. But for one other, we're locked in through the WTO into a set of trade relationships that don't allow us to simply cut it off. I don't think that we would do that anyway. And I think if we did, the Chinese would consider it a direct assault on their national sovereignty and
integrity. So is it inevitable?
Let me look at it as
I'd
the way.
I'd like the chance to respond to both of them when you're done.
I think that the issue for China is the fact I can't think that China is happy to see North Korea becoming a nuclear weapons state with long-range missiles. The problem is that China is equally scared about a total meltdown of the state with a lot of Koreans coming across the peninsula. I think what China would like to see after Dear Leader is gone would be something that looked a lot more like the Chinese economic program that revived Korea, and where they could, I think that they're not willing to put the real pressure on them for fear that the country will itself implode.
Bruno?
Well, I'd like to first of all, I've heard both those critiques, and they make a lot of sense. I'm just throw that out there like as an intellectual thought piece. But here's the other side of it that a lot of people don't realize, particularly conservatives, my friends on the conservative side of the aisle who it's everybody's always 10 feet tall. It's not the Japanese, it's the Germans or the Russians, and really nobody's 10 feet tall. The fact of the matter is that China holds all our debt, but if that debt becomes worthless, they're hurt worse than we are. If in a rising tide lifting all boats and all that metaphorical stuff about that about those things, the whole world relies on the American economy. We have so much more clout than we think we have. Everybody wants to say we've become too weak. The fact is that we do have some leverage over China. As to the point that you're saying where they say that would be considered an act of war, you couldn't just do it overnight. But if you went to them on the back channels and said, look, this is an untenable situation. You want help with the refugees streaming over the border? You want help with foreign aid coming in to help the North Koreans after 70 years or 8 or 50 years of insanity and two insane leaders? We'll give you all the help you want, but you've got to stop this because we can't have them become a nuclear power.
Let's go to David in San Francisco listening to us on the internet. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi, Bruce and your guest.
Hello.
You know, I was interested in – I've been hearing the budget cuts coming in through the military, and it's pretty obvious that many of these budget cuts are for programs that were dangerous to the military. In other words, if cronyism got us buying projects that were actually useless or dangerous, then that's bad for the troops. And it's very necessary to cut those projects because they not only do they give us a sense of false security, but they also put us in danger because it makes criminals essentially richer and more liable to sell bad equipment to America. So I was very much interested in seeing the propaganda that's coming through about how these budget cuts are happening.
Your reaction to Charles?
I'd like to take a little bit of an issue in a friendly way with the caller. I think that what's happening is that the military, which has always been built around very large platforms, the biggest airplanes, the biggest tanks, these big systems, which were essentially all built around the idea that we faced what was called a peer competitor in the sense that that would be the Soviet Union in the past and in the future perhaps China. What Gates is really saying is what we are facing now is a series of smaller wars that are often going to be in cities. They're going to involve small sets of troops. You need sharpshooters. You need fast lift capabilities. You need that sort of thing. You need to deal with Iran, Korea, Afghanistan, Iraq, those kinds of contingencies. I don't think this is about cronyism in that sense. I think it's about shifting the orientation. You remember when Rumsfeld said, you go into the war with the army you have, not the army you want, right. The military you have, not the military you want. Well, that was a long time ago he said it. And we've still got that old military. We had too few troops. We had the wrong equipment. What they're trying to do now is go into the future conflicts with the military that we should have.
Jim in South Elgin on WLS and Coast to Coast, you're on the air.
Good afternoon. Good show, gentlemen.
Thank you.
This whole Somali thing really dovetails very well with the Second Amendment debate here locally in the United States, because every time you have people that are weak, they can't defend themselves. And the Somali pirates knew there was a few cannons riding on those boats. With those little dinghies, they wouldn't even come close. You could blow them out for half a mile away.
So you want them armed?
Absolutely. And, I mean, it just shows here in the country.
Well, here's the situation, though. You want them armed, I mean, at least based on the press over the last week when this has been on the front page of a lot of newspapers. The owners of these ship and these companies, they don't want to arm them.
Well,
their point is, you know, if we have to pay some ransom, that's the cost of doing business.
Well,
they're not demanding this.
Well, I think that they're too politically correct. And look at the debate here locally with the Second Amendment issues. When people are weak, the bad guys take over.
I'm not going to make the argument against you, but I want you to understand what the people who are going to be on the other side of that are going to say. The first thing they're going to say is that there have been a lot of pirate takeovers, but very few people killed. What these people want is money, and as soon as you start arming, they're going to, in effect, assume everybody on the ship is going to be trying to kill them, so they're going to be coming on with a lot more weaponry themselves. The second thing is that apparently a lot of the pirates that take over have come out masquerading as fishermen. So if you shoot at some of these boats when they're coming close, you run the danger that you're actually shooting at fishing vessels, and then the people who are running those boats are going to be very worried about their legal liabilities.
The other idea, I think we mentioned earlier, probably independent security firms that would be hired, like security guards, like they're hired in every other business. If the companies really want to do that, they will take less profits, and they'll put some of those profits back into preserving the safety of their crew and their merchandise as opposed to the bottom line. Back shortly from Chicago with more calls. From Youngstown, Ohio to Austin, Texas, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway, 1-800-723-8289. More calls in just a moment. Charles Lipson, you were bringing up a point during the break about the role that insurance could play in this issue.
One of the reasons that we have a lot less oil spilling around the seas is that we have double-hulled tankers. And why do we have double-hulled tankers? Not because you can't flag a ship with a single hull, which is cheaper to build and cheaper to use. But the fact is, insurance companies will no longer insure them, and American and European ports won't allow single-hull tankers to come in and offload their oil. So it's the combination of the insurance and the ports. One of the questions that I have, and it's really at this point just a question, is whether our insurance companies that insure these maritime cargoes could themselves prevent the payment of ransoms. If they were pre-committed to the non-payment of ransom, then you'd have a whole different, and potentially if they were going to require at least some of the ships to have arms or other kinds of deterrent of force.
We have been talking about this evening from the United States perspective why piracy is bad. Make the case for piracy.
The case for piracy?
Yeah, what is the case for piracy?
Well, the economic logic for these pirates is that they're living near very lucrative cargoes that are coming by them, and they themselves have no fish in those waters. Those waters have been, by the Russians and others, completely fished out. They live in a country with no economy and no government. So these they live in villages where, in effect, a lot of people have boats. They can go out there. And my understanding of what happens is that, in effect, fishermen go out, they're hiding guns, they go out, they try to take over a ship. Once they do, they in effect hook up with a local mafiosi group, you know, experienced pirates who do the negotiating, and there's a three-way cut between the fishermen who take over the boat, in effect, the mafioso who do the negotiating and may supply backup force, and the village elders in these three or four villages where the pirates are sent out from. I think that we've got to go into those villages and do a carrot and stick approach where we can do something that helps with economic development and solidifying those villages, but at the same time make the village elders and others vulnerable if they don't go along.
So this is an economic facts of life, an economic situation that is not likely to change any more than it is for poor, poverty-stricken people in Mexico to stop them from trying to get into the United States.
I would put it a little differently. I think that these people are much more like the people who bring the immigrants across the borders. That is, the people who are these organized criminal groups who hook up with the poor people rather than the poor people themselves.
Let's go to Nick in El Paso, Texas, listening to us on KTSM. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes.
Okay.
Bruce. I read about in USA Today about an article about 2 months ago.
Yes.
About where the FBI is investigating Iman in Twin Cities of Minnesota, Minneapolis, St. Paul, where there's a large community of immigrant Somalis, and
that's
the
correct.
Iman was
that's
recruiting
correct.
Somalis to go and do jihad in Somalia. And so I wouldn't be surprised if they were American citizens, these guys. And also, they got like 260 hostages down there, and the pirates are going to Mombasa, Kenya, and purchasing their boats to do the piracy.
Let's let Phillips got a comment on what you had to say.
The real danger, I think, for Somalia is the absence of any kind of organized government, because that power hates a vacuum, and that vacuum is going to be filled and was filled for some time by Al-Qaeda and will be filled again, or if it isn't already, by extremist groups like that. So I think it's easy for Somalis in this country who are attracted, encouraged to that lifestyle to end up back in Somalia and then back here entering the country as the 9/11 hijackers did legally. There was no sneaking across the border, fake passports. Those hijackers came into our country legally.
And there was a horrible story out of Britain this week. I think that the caller has pointed to a real problem, which is the Somali immigrants that have not been well integrated into Minneapolis and been recruited to go back and participate in East African jihad. But the story in Britain
– is it, are you talking about the conspiracy?
Yes. This is
an
Al-Qaeda bombing conspiracy, but all of those people came in on the student visas. And apparently there were something on the order of 30,000 to 40,000 people that came in from Afghanistan and Pakistan into Britain last year. How can you keep an eye on all these people?
This was an investigation that had to be stopped because the security, basically, they're Britain's equivalent to the Homeland Security. He very foolishly was seen in public carrying papers that were facing out that, again, were made public on the internet, which basically described what the plot was.
Well, and the
that also is another movie to be made.
It's another movie to be made. But
let me
just tell you that on the night of December the 7th, 1941, you know, when
day that will live.
You know who
infamy.
Had dinner with who was scheduled to have dinner that night was Edward R. Murrow. And Edward R. Murrow had dinner with Eleanor Roosevelt. Edward and his wife had dinner with Eleanor Roosevelt. And later in the dinner, Franklin came down. He'd been spending all day dealing with the Japanese bombing of Pearl Harbor. He then took Edward R. Murrow into his study and talked all night about these security issues. Edward R. Murrow said, "I had the greatest story of anybody ever, and I decided not to report it."
Yeah.
Now,
happen,
if anybody
today.
Gets a photograph of secret things blowing an Al-Qaeda operation, they'd publish them on the internet tomorrow.
We got to pause. 1-800-723-8289. We got another full hour. We got a lot of callers on the line. We've touched a nerve, and we're going to bring them all into our conversation when we roll on, wherever you're listening, from coast to coast and border to border, on America's great radio stations, as well as Sirius and XM satellite radio. There virtually isn't any way you can't get this program. We're also on the internet at beyondthebeltway.com, and we got lots going on, another full hour, entertaining you, informing you every Sunday night from coast to coast and border to border. I'm Bruce Dumont, back shortly from Chicago. From Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont. We continue with hour number two of Beyond the Beltway, tonight featuring commentary by Bruno Barron, Philip Beverly, and Charles Lipsom. Our phones remain open at 1-800-723-8029, coming to you from the Sirius XM radio studios on Chicago's Great West Side. And also our email address is wide open at btb@museum.tv, btb@museum.tv. We have a lot of callers that are left over from our first hour, so let us go to them right now. Let's go to Robert in Naperville, listening to us on WLS Radio. You've been very patient, and we thank you for it.
Hey, Bruce, congratulations on one of the best shows in the history of broadcasting.
Well, that's quite an accolade. Well, I appreciate your comment.
Particularly appreciate it because I think the guests tonight have really shined.
They've been terrific.
Right? Just honest.
Well, we've been doing this. We're in our 29th year of this broadcast, and we're going to hopefully, Lord willing, keep doing it for many, many more years.
I sure hope so.
Thank you.
Bruce, on the first of all, couple of thoughts on first the hostage scenario and then the overall scenario regarding the world scene and the economy and so forth. Mm-hmm. In my opinion, and I'd like some more thought from your honored guests on their thoughts, when you let thugs and legalized crime shine, in other words, when the world knows all they got to do is give them so much money, do you think that's setting a tone for, you know, next time around I think we'll ask for some more, and before you know it, they think they can get away with anything. That's why I was so impressed with, personally, Barack Obama saying to some of the greatest men and women that ever shined, the Navy SEALs, we can't keep letting this occur.
I think that you've absolutely put your finger on something very important. It's one thing, and we talk about it with corruption tax here in Chicago. It's one thing if it's a little bit of a tax. It's another thing when projects are sort of begin to be completely affected by what that tax is going to be. And there, too, we've talked only about piracy, but there's another kind of piracy. What the U.S., as Philip said earlier, we no longer manufacture very much. What we do is intellectual property. All four of us at this table, we don't manufacture things with our hands. We manufacture things with our brains. And the fact is, there's a huge amount of piracy in China and elsewhere, but that's intellectual property. Once you've done a movie, it may cost you $250 million to do the movie. It costs you 60 cents to duplicate a DVD of it. And the same thing is true of a $100 million computer program. We need much better enforcement against not only piracy on the high seas, but against intellectual piracy as well.
But Robert, let me just ask this question to our other guests, and then I'm going to give you the opportunity to respond to it. But I want to ask Bruno the question. Based on the scenario that Charles Lipsom described in our previous hour, mm-hmm. which was the economic reason why the pirates do what they do, because they're trying to make money. So money is a goal of theirs, and also there's a desire to spread some of that money around to get more food to those who are back home, including their own families. Mm-hmm. So my question to you is, if you don't deal with that economic issue, it seems to me that all of the laws and all of the potential enforcement, all of the potential punishment that you might come up with or the world might come up with It may have a little dent on it, but it isn't going to stop the pirates from pirating.
No, it probably won't. And this is where this is where our friends on the liberal side of the aisle have a point or two to make. And I think it's time that people on the left and people of the right who are not corrupt and who are decent started having a decent conversation across the aisle. Fact of the matter is that when you have our side of the world that is so unbelievably rich, I mean, the West and capitalism and free markets are capable of throwing off so much wealth, and they do. And then that wealth doesn't get around to the rest of the world, and there's people who are and this is not spread the wealth. I'm not talking about taxing the rich and handing it to the poor. I'm talking about freeing out your markets and making your markets open so people can sell what they know to have our intellectual property and our intellectual growth spread around the world so everybody else has a shot at the title. Until we do that, we're going to be in this lawless situation that Rob is talking about. I have a friend, as long as we're telling stories here, the Russians and their brilliant programmers, I talked to a security analyst the other day on a different topic. The Russians steal millions of dollars from American banks every year, just millions. And American banks, they don't want to go after the Russians. They don't want to get in trouble with the rough guys that work for some of them. They just pay it. And we just pay the pirates. And we just pay the Russians. And we just let the Chinese get away with what they get away with. And we let the Iranians build a bomb. And what's happened to the West is we've become so fat and happy and rich that we're just like, oh, can't we just pay these people and pretend everything is fine in our nice little suburban, little rich society? And what we don't understand is that the rest of the world is getting increasingly rotten and more aggressive, because they're not getting a shot at our title. They're not getting a shot at the freedom and everything that we have to offer. They're getting rich from crime.
Philip, what's your reaction to that?
I think the thing that we're missing about Somalia is that they're not a peer exactly. And I'm not one to think that money is going to solve our problems, that somehow we can rebuild their economy and we should be in the nation building business. I think it's enough that we protect our interest, keep trade routes open and sea lanes and communication lanes open, use our national power to do that. And I think it's incumbent upon some in the Islamist world, given that Somalia is an Islamic country, for them to start making some contributions in that way. The Saudis have plenty of money to invest, and I don't see them necessarily reaching out in the Islamic world to do the sort of nation building that I think they could do along a different cultural line. I think it's really hard for us to given where we're at in our history, to think that we can go in and do any kind of Marshall Plan like we did after World War II. That's not the world we live in. I think the world we live in is we need to protect ourselves, protect our assets, protect our interests, and exert or have the pirates, for example, pay a cost that they're not willing to pay in trying to stop the piracy.
Well, what role as an influencer does the United States really have in these situations? And Robert, let me go back to you to sort of answer that question.
Well, in my opinion, Bruce, I believe that if the United States stands up and does, it might sound naive, but does the right thing, and as the gentleman earlier a moment ago said, protects our own interests and shows the world. I know that the president has asked Europe to step up to the plate, but it just seems like historically, every time we ask certain countries to step up to the plate, it always comes back to guess who's doing the heavy lifting.
I think one of the issues, I think you put your finger right on it. I think Philip put his finger right on it. One of the problems that the United States has, we've talked about China, we've talked about North Korea, we've talked about Iran, we've talked about Pakistan, we've talked about Somalia. Listen to all those interests. We can't cover everything. We need help from others, and we need a conception of our own self-interest that doesn't spread us out doing a little of everything everywhere. We simply can't do it.
Phone number is 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. I'm Bruce Dumont, back shortly from Chicago. From Hollywood, California to Hollywood, Florida, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. 1-800-723-8289 is the telephone number. 1-800-723-8289. I'm going to switch gears and move to a new area of discussion now, although if you're listening to the broadcast and want to call in on some issues that we've already been discussing, your calls will be welcome on that issue as well. But I want to talk about something that is near and dear to everyone who is at the table this evening, and that is reform that is desperately needed in the state of Illinois, but reform that is also, I believe, desperately needed perhaps in all of the cities and all of the counties and states in which this program airs every Sunday night. Charles, you came here last week as a guest armed to talk about reform, and we got off into a long, very heated conversation about gay marriage, so I've invited you to come back. But again, just to put it in context to those who are listening to this program all over the United States this evening, how irate, in your view, are your friends and neighbors about the need for reform in the state of Illinois, given the recent arrest and indictment of the former governor?
I think that there's a lot of vigorously voiced feelings about the need for reform. Now, my area around the University of Chicago, the sort of lakefront liberal area, has traditionally been a reform area. But my sense is that that under the economic crunch that's going on now, some of the old trade-offs no longer apply. The old trade-off that people were talking about was Chicago's willing to allow a little corruption to go on as long as everything gets done. Your garbage gets picked up and the potholes are filled and so forth. I think two things have happened here. One is that people no longer are sure that there's a little corruption. They think that there's a lot of corruption. And the second thing is that the potholes aren't filled. There's in this economic crunch with taxes in Cook County now, sales taxes at over 10% are the highest in the country. And people feel like the rates in our parking meters are so high that people are literally destroying the parking meters. So people are feeling that they're paying through the nose and they're not getting the government they're paying for. And my sense is that that is widely felt. I saw you shaking your head, Philip.
Yes, absolutely. And I've seen it sort of up close down at our place recently. We're in the search for a new president.
And this is a state university the south side of Chicago.
Public university that should be very open in terms of how it conducts the public's business, because it does spend the public's money. And yet this process has been much, much less than transparent. And
folks the previous president was thrown out for essentially corruption.
Exactly. And that, I think, extends naturally. I don't think some people got the memo after Barack's election that it could be a new day in politics, that we're not going to do things the way that we'd been doing them before.
Well, do you sense, Bruno, because, again, you work primarily the Republican side of the
right.
aisle, if you will. But again, I want to just speak at this moment about the level of concern and anger out there. How widespread is it?
I wish I knew exactly. And the other thing that I wish I knew, or at least I wish I had some control over, is that to take whatever anger there is and properly focus it. The American people of Illinois in general, I mean everybody seems to really want to stomp their feet and bang their head against a wall. They want to make a lot of noise and complain about how much they hate Rob Blagojevich. But at the same time, if you just look at the recent elections, there were a few incumbents got tossed out, just April 7th. But when you really look at it, the same people go to the polls, the same and going back to your last hour, the same pirates control the same municipal budgets of the same school districts and the same state universities, and those pirates have control over all of those funds. They're not transparent. I'll just brag them for a minute and say that I'm working for a guy named Adam Angievsky, who's running for governor as a Republican, and he built his entire campaign and platform around transparency. And we need to make every dime of public money 100% transparent so that people can see where it's going. And that in and of itself is not a left or right issue. That's just like once we see where it's going, we can start pointing it in more legal
direction than having a debate about that. Let me ask you a question, okay. Bruce. You hear phone calls week after week. You travel around the country. How broad do you think that this movement is for reform? This is this involves people like Chris Dodd in the Senate. They take a favorable loan from exactly the people they're regulating. I mean, could you tell me how broad it is?
I think that people are upset. I think the level of anger is growing. But I don't believe that it is at fever pitch yet. I still believe that most people, or many people, not most, but many people are too content with the way things are going. Or that's the way it always is. That's the way it will always be. They don't want to go the extra effort to fight. To me, what has been depressing over the corruption that is within the state and within the city of Chicago. Because virtually you don't get anything done unless you pay somebody off. You really don't. I mean that's you know, you want a city that works. I'm saying something, you know, out of school perhaps, with a program that comes from Chicago. That's what makes Chicago work.
And that
is unfortunate because a lot of those dollars don't go where they should go to improve efficiency.
And if you need zoning to be changed, for example, to build something, to build a store, or change any kind of zoning,
you have to go to your alderman.
Well, your alderman, you can rest assured, is going to want a campaign.
And we have
a
situation again because the people around the country, you know, have been following, the story of our former governor Rob Blagojevich. Who is now, under indictment? He was going to take a bad system and was going to make it worse from the get go in building his political career. This is the allegation and the implication of the federal indictment. He was going to take a bad system and he was going to make it worse for his benefit. And what concerns me is that there are too many people who still are working in Illinois on the state payroll who were enablers of Rod Blagojevich.
Well, it's
he was not the only one.
Absolutely
some of them
not.
Have been indicted. Some of them are gone. But there are enablers, including the former budget director, John Filon. He is still on the state budget in the state of Illinois.
Yes. Well, and Bruce, let's name names.
I just did.
If the people of Illinois are dumb enough to elect Lisa Madigan governor after her father has been in virtually the first, second, or third most powerful politician in this state— and he's a Speaker of the House. If they're dumb enough to elect her governor, they deserve everything they get. If the people in the 14th district, Republicans up
but
there,
but also, I mean, he was the principal antagonist for Rod Blagojevich.
Well, I don't agree with all of that. I do because he is the system, and the book I wrote was about the Constitution, the system that these people work under. They created it. Michael Madigan is as guilty as Rod Blagojevich for the condition of the state. And let me go on the other side and say that if the people in the 14th district of Illinois, congressional district, if the Republicans up there are silly enough, just unbelievably silly enough, to put another Hastert, Dennis Hastert's son is now – Dennis Hastert is like pushing his son. If they put another Hastert – this is the problem is the politics in Illinois. You're right. Some of the people are comfortable with this system. And the other people out there that are mad don't know what to do about it. They don't think they can do anything, so they don't do anything about it. And they go back to the polls and vote for the same corrupt losers. And that's true of a Madigan, and it's true of a Hastert.
Well, first of all, do you think people do that, and why do they do it?
It's the challenge that I face most often in my class, not with political science majors because they're all hooked into the dark side anyway. It's the other students who have such a view of politics that there's nothing that they can do, that it's so corrupt that they don't even really want to be involved in it. And trying to get them to connect the dots about how it actually affects their lives and that they don't have to become political junkies like me but start paying attention is really hard.
I think there are two big problems that are at the core of it. One is that it now takes so much money and so much name recognition to get elected that you spend all your time raising money. And the second thing is a line that the comic writer P.J. O'Rourke said, when government controls what you can buy and sell, then the first thing to be bought and sold are legislators.
And what is likely to change?
How do you break that
vice-like grip?
It's the collision of First Amendment and my right to give excessive amounts of money to politicians and what they have in other countries, which is public financing, genuine, legitimate public financing of elections.
There's not going to be public
financing.
And look at who undercut it in the last election. Barack Obama, who had promised that he was going to take public financing, as soon as he realized that he could raise four or five times as much money as his opponent, opted out of the system. And there's no – the taxpayers are not going to put more money into this system. Quite the contrary. What you need – among other things, we are very fortunate in having Patrick Fitzgerald, who was appointed by a rogue senator, Peter Fitzgerald. He would have never been appointed by the Democrats in control here. They've always tried to avoid having a serious U.S. Attorney.
Yeah.
And we need serious U.S. attorneys, and we need to be above politics, and they need to go after public corruption.
But it's your belief that it is that's a majoritarian position. Do you think a majority of the people are cheering this?
I do not think that a majority of people I think a majority of people would like to see less corruption, but I don't think it's the highest priority for most people. On the other hand, I think that they would be happy to see corrupt public officials genuinely investigated, and I have a few names for them.
Okay, well, we'll give those names when we come back. 1-800-723-8029. From coast to coast and border to border, naming names every Sunday night. Back shortly. From Knoxville, Tennessee to Memphis, Tennessee, you are listening to Beyond the Beltway, 1-800-723-8029, 1-800-723-8029. Bruno Berend is here. He is a political consultant. He's an author. He is also the conductor of ExtremeWisdom.com, which is where you will find his Extreme Wisdom at ExtremeWisdom.com. Also, Philip Beverly joins us. He is an associate professor of political science for the last 17 and a half years at Chicago State University on Chicago's South Side. And Charles Lipson from the University of Chicago and the Pride of Marks, Mississippi, also joins us. He is a professor at the U of C. How many years there, Charles?
33.
33 years.
Well, 32, something like that. But who's counting? I can hold a job, Phil. 17 and a half years? A mere babe. A mere babe you are.
Here I thought I was senior.
And you were offering advice on Bruno how he can become a political science professor during the break. One other piece of advice that we talked about during the break was that you were making the point about the frustration that exists with some people and mm-hmm. whether or not we are in a unique situation. And by the way, just to answer the question that you asked me in the last segment, Charles, I think what people are angry about is they're angry about political issues when they become easy to understand and violate the law of common sense. So that when you have a government that gives out large sums of money, billions and billions of dollars, and then can't report to the people how the money was spent, they get angry about that. I think they get angry about, frankly, when potholes are not repaired. And so, and I think when they see a city that can't repair its potholes, that's putting all of its eggs in trying to bring the Olympics to Chicago in 8 years, that to a lot of people doesn't make a lot of sense. So I think they get irate about that. Now, whether or not their anger is to a level where they're actually going to get any significant change, that is the big question. We recently had a special election in Illinois to replace replace Rahm Emanuel in Congress. It was embarrassing what the turnout was, very, very low. But my question to you, Bruno, because you were making a point, you also, one of the things that you do in private life is you're a computer direct mail database wizard.
Not direct mail, but database consultant.
And you have come up with a plan where you think that someone can they can take over their precinct.
Yes,
how to do it.
Exactly. Any person listening to my voice, they don't have to be a Democrat. They don't have to be a Republican. They can take over their precinct.
Oh.
You can go to Aristotle voter lists online, or you can get them. It's a little bit messier, but you can get the data for free from your local county official. You can find out all the voter data of your precinct. You can find the borders of your precinct. And once you decide that you want to print up a card or you want to knock on people's doors and you want to tell them what you think, you can take over your precinct. If you're a Republican or a Democratic precinct captain, every Republican gubernatorial candidate will return your phone call. maybe not really close to an election, but while they're thinking about running, they'll return your phone call. So you call them up and say, I'm either going to deliver my precinct for or against you, and they're going to come over and they're going to talk to you. This is real power. And I'll tell you, this is where for those people listening who are on the right, if they want to have any hope of taking back this country, they have to stop listening to radio hosts and they have to stop listening to Michael Steele, and they need to start taking over their precinct.
Please stay tuned till the end of the hour.
Right. But in, but again, if you have, obviously, we could have more people listening from one particular precinct. Mm-hmm. So now you have competing interests in one particular precinct.
More people getting politically active is not a bad thing in this country. We need to get people who have a little bit less time on American Idol and a little bit less time trying to find the swimsuit issue. And they need to look at what's happening in their culture. They need to get rid of corrupt Republicans, and they need to get rid of corrupt Democrats, and they need to get good people in there.
We're going to take a call. Let's go to Salvador, listening to us in Rockford, Illinois, on WLS. You're on the air, Salvador. He's not on the air. Okay, I'm sorry about that. Charles, you want to add anything to that?
No, I think that they are that most Americans actually don't want to be especially involved in politics.
They
most Americans want to. In fact, the old Greek ideal, the Aristotle, when you said that that's the name of the database, the Greek ideal was that everybody participated in politics. But the modern liberal ideal, meaning for the last several hundred years, has been essentially that the point about politics is to provide a framework in which we can go about tending our own garden. And I think that it's rare when people feel like the public issues impinge on them. So much that they want to be involved. I sense that now is a moment, and I was pleased to hear President Obama on the air the other day talking about more people volunteering. I think that volunteering, you talked about taking over a precinct, but there are lots of ways to be involved. Both of my cousins on both sides of my family, their children who are in their early 20s have just graduated college, and both have gone out, on both sides, have gone out to spend a year doing volunteer work, one with new immigrant families, that kind of thing. So I think that there are a lot of different ways for people to be involved. My sense is that young people want to go out and teach for America. They want to do the things. We need to provide frameworks, but they also need to know that somebody's not stealing all the money out from under their nose.
Well, why in your view, Philip, is why are so many people tolerant, and people have been tolerant of decaying government, decaying public morals for over the last 50 years? There has been a spiral downward in many of the measuring points of life in the big city, and people aren't—they're not exercised about it. And some of the people who've been dealt the worst cards, that are on the shortest end of the stick, seem to be the most tolerant of it.
And I think there's two things that are going on here. One of them is this belief that they have no personal power, that they are sort of buffeted about by the winds of whatever their lives are. And the second thing, I don't think that they've been as directly impacted by, say, corruption as would need to happen for them to go, oh, wait a second, I have to do something about that. It's one thing to sort of not have your trash picked up. But most aldermen that I know are going to be really good about their streets and sand superintendent making sure that they don't get them unelected.
But where is the outrage when you have a school system that does not graduate anywhere near a majority of the students that start schools, whether you're black, white, or Hispanic? You have school systems in most major cities that are not successful. And you also have people who live in particular neighborhoods. They're primarily poor. They're primarily black. Many of them are literally within 5 minutes of where we're doing this program right now. They cannot even go out of their house at night for fear that they're going to be
shot. The usual explanation.
And what is the explanation?
The usual explanation is that the schools are run for the adults. That is, they're run for the teachers and they're run for the bureaucrats. That police services are run for those organizations. That Streets and Sand is run for the political organization that can give the people those things or for the unions. Those are concentrated people with a lot – concentrated organizations with a lot of a lot at stake. How else could we have the kind of school system that has perpetuated this kind of failure generation after generation in large urban settings without giving people choices?
And there's no incentive here for the decision makers to actually improve this. If you turn out a citizen who's got critical thinking skills and problem-solving skills in a corrupt sort of environment, they may figure out how to replace those in power. And those in power, let's face it, they don't want to be replaced.
So the people in power want to keep the public stupid.
Yes.
And does everybody agree with that?
No, I don't. I think what the people in power want to do is be reelected. And
but are those two?
But I think that they would, to the extent that the more money and jobs they control, the easier it is for them to get elected. And what you're seeing now is, in my opinion, a government that has grown so large with so many resources that it is almost impossible to stamp out corruption.
But if you have
such incentives.
Bruno.
Yep. I think Charles has put his finger on it. And the incentives have to come from focused anger on the people who still have the power to turn these people out. And it's an open question of whether they can succeed. This is a system the benefit of the bureaucratic class. And with the first hour, we talked about pirates. When you have enough political power to say, I'm getting a 20% bonus for 4 years straight to artificially jack up my salary so that I can artificially create a pension that I don't deserve and retire at age 52 because I have a right to, and I'm going to live off of the public, maybe some investments in an investment fund, but I'm going to live off the public for the last 30 years of my life. When you have that much political power that you can get that from the taxpayer, I would call that piracy.
But you also have a situation where many of the people who are in the position to do exactly as you have said, there was a book written a couple of years ago about I think what's wrong with Kansas. The basic point of the book was, it was a liberal who wrote the book, basically why are people out in middle America, why do they vote against their own self-interest?
Maybe he doesn't have a good concept of their self-interest.
Well, the point of the book was right. why are they voting for so many conservative Republican principles when that may not be in the best interest? That was his political perspective. My political perspective, looking at it from a little different manner, point of view, and that is, why do people who are victims, they are victims of their own experiences, they're victims of a poor school system, they're a victim of poor representation, why do they keep electing and reelecting over and over and over and over again the same people who created the cesspool of life that they have to live in every day? That's my question. 1-800-723-8289. I'm Bruce Dumont. From Poughkeepsie, New York to Sugarland, Texas, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway, 1-800-723-8289. Let's reach out to Susan. She's standing by the radio tonight listening to us on WLS Radio. Susan, nice to hear from you tonight.
Hi. Do you think the mainstream media does any real hard-nosed reporting, investigating reporting? Or do they just throw softball questions at the politicians? Aren't they of the liberal agenda, with the exception of much of AM talk radio? I'm talking about NBC, CBS, ABC, the major newspapers, the New York Times.
I would say that the major media, as in an investigative sense, defined by newspapers, and I'm obviously judging this from a prism of having lived in Chicago for many, many years. I do think that the newspapers have done a pretty good job of aggressively trying to root out public corruption as they have seen it. So one of the concerns that I have is that as the newspaper industry is going through really difficult times, I do fear the loss of newspapers. I do feel the cutback of their staffs. They're prohibited from maybe doing as many investigative pieces as they would like. And I would say that the newspapers have done a terrific job, a much better job than the electronic television stations have done, who I would say 10, 15 years ago, they were doing investigative pieces. The level of their investigative pieces now are not what they were 10, 15 years ago. And I think that's depressing.
Okay. I just thinking of Bernie Goldberg's new book, The Slobbering Love Affair.
Now you're getting into a sort of a national media perspective, and I would say that from a national media perspective, because of the tremendous amount of money that can be made by the major television networks, there's a limit to how far their news departments will go. They will do things that will titillate the audience. They will do things that will get the audience riled up. But when it comes time to significant political change, I think they pull back a little bit.
I don't think that's necessarily the case
with local corruption, because I think the Sun-Times and the Tribune in Chicago have done a pretty good job
lately.
They've been very, very weak
for a long time, and then maybe the blue bloods who run those papers they're actually starting to get angry about their property tax bills and the pensions to some of the superintendents. But
they also have conflicts of interest, which they're the first ones to talk about conflict of interest. But again, they have a little of their own. I mean, you know, when you're going for the Tribune Company and you're trying to get a tax break to buy Wrigley Field or sell Wrigley Field.
Exactly.
Well, that's what Blagojevich exploited.
That's right.
And the listeners out in the rest of the country need to know that if they're reading headlines about what's going on in Illinois and California, it's coming to a state near you. Some states are better run than others. Some states are more transparent than others. But you're looking at two states that could conceivably be approaching bankruptcy or at least federal court filings over pensions because of the financial distress.
I think that the caller is pointing to something that's real, but is confusing two different issues. One is whether there's kind of general political bias in certain kind of reporting. The other, and you can argue back and forth on that. I have my views, which are actually kind of closer to the caller's maybe than some other people's. But the fact is, I don't think that has much to do with investigative reporting. You have congressmen like John Murtha who need to be investigated, senators like Chris Dodd, who was taking favorable loans from people he was regulating. Those kind of people need to be investigated. They were not investigated by their local papers. TV is never going to investigate that sort of thing. That's the sort of thing that a media ought to be able to do. They don't have subpoena power, it's true, but a lot of this stuff didn't need to be raked over by a U.S. attorney before people found it.
Well, and again, I think you have to look at the U.S. Attorney's Office, not exclusively in Chicago, but also the U.S. Attorney jurisdiction in most jurisdictions around the United States. They have done some of the most significant cleaning up of anti-corruption. So thank God for the United States Justice Department, who frequently turns this power. And sometimes,
that's true.
Sometimes they apparently abuse it, as they did with Ted Stevens.
But there is one thing I want to – before we paint every state with the same brush – I think it would be worth talking, Bruce. You have a national audience, and you interview people from all over. There are states, Wisconsin, Minnesota, other states, mm-hmm. that have been known as traditionally having fairly clean politics. And, in fact, I would be interested in what's different about those states and whether they see the trend as going in the wrong direction, whether they would say, oh, Charles, you're thinking about things 10 years ago. They're not so clean in our state anymore. But there have been states, especially in the upper Midwest, that are thought of as traditionally pretty clean states.
Let's go to Zach in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, guys, my cell phone's got really bad reception, but all I wanted to say was what bothers me more than the corruption that you guys are talking about is local municipalities really just hampering new construction going on, new development, which is still in the job. And I know at least here in South Carolina.
You're talking about corruption in construction in general and the letting out of construction contracts?
Contracting, right. Well, that's where there's big money to be made, and that's where look for the campaign contributions, and they will follow, and whether that
and road construction, that
road
sort of
construction,
thing,
big dollars,
welcome building stimulus dollars,
building roads to nowhere and prisons in.
We need to watch the stimulus, Bruce. There's a lot of money going out. It's going out quickly, and I hope that there'll be really close scrutiny as it goes out.
I will predict that there will be a scandal or two on how the money is being spent at some point.
Let's take a vacation, Bruce, with that money.
Our phone lines are going to close up because we're out of time. Our thanks this evening to Bruno Barron and Philip Beverly and Charles Lipson for joining us this evening. This is a Jenna B. production produced in association with WLS Talk Radio. Our thanks to Tom Veracruz and Ben Stewart for their assistance in the production of this program. Happy Easter, everybody. Until next week at the same time, I'm Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.